With me today is a very special guest, Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And I believe, are you, Mark, first, welcome to the podcast. I'm pleased to have you on board.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Are you still the book review editor over at Quarterly Journal Australia, Journal of Austrian Economics?
I sure am. I've been the book review editor for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics for about 10 years. And the journal basically publishes all of the leading edge economics related to the Austrian school. And I was marveling at it in reviewing the last year's production of the journal, is that we had such a fabulously high number of articles relating to and extending and improving the Austrian theory of the business cycle, which has really got everybody's attention. And I thought to myself, you know, we could cherry pick some of those articles and make a fine, fine book that not just academics would want to read, but, you know, business people and people who are concerned, you know, financial people, or just people interested in investing their own money, and they want to understand, why does the stock market go up so high, and then why does it crash, and then we get the whole thing over again. And so there's some really good stuff in there, as well as some of the book reviews that I've engineered from usually the young leading scholars in our field, looking at either books in Austrian economics or books in the mainstream that need to be critiqued and analyzed and things of that nature. And anybody can get the journal for free online at Mises.org. As a matter of fact, you can get virtually everything free from Mises.org. It's one of the largest economic web pages in the world, and the center of and the heart of the Austrian school.
And I might add to that, too, you know, a lot of the books that I talk about here on the podcast are actually available as PDFs or other style downloads at the Mises Institute. It's just in economics or the economic end of the liberty discussion.
Yeah, you know, if you go to the site and you see a book that you're interested in, what I do is I do a search for the title plus PDF, and up pops the PDF, and I can examine it, look at the table of contents, you know, things of that nature, get a feel for whether or not the book might be valuable for me at this time. And if it is, you can either just read off the PDF, or you can buy a very low-cost ebook or EPUB, or just, you know, what I do is just order the hardback or paperback version of them, because, you know, we subsidize the books, and so the prices are very, very reasonable, where, you know, a mainstream textbook or a mainstream book in economics or just about any other field is going to cost you over $100. Most of our books that we publish, the paperbacks are usually less than $20 or less. So it's very reasonable. It's almost not worth, you know, reading off of the computer screen, because it's just so inexpensive. And we have hundreds of these books. And in our bookstore, we have you know, hundreds and hundreds of books, and as well as, you know, T-shirts and coffee cups and all that kind of paraphernalia type stuff.
Now, I wanted to ask you today, and I've had a lot of people giving me questions as well, but I wanted to ask you about Bitcoins today, because, you know, that's a buzz that's sweeping the internet. It's now gone over, or last I checked, it was over $100 per Bitcoin. And there's a lot of confusion about Bitcoins. You know, how do Austrians consider Bitcoins? Because the origin of Bitcoins doesn't really match the typical story that we think of. What are your thoughts generally on Bitcoin?
Well, it's definitely all the rage, you know, and it's hitting us from all sides. And I don't pretend to be an expert in the area, but I can tell you that our webpage, Mises.org, was always in the top 10 of economic webpages, usually like number 5 or 6, something like that. And Bitcoin webpages, because they're also considered economic webpages, has pushed us down to like 24 or 25. So you know something is going completely viral in terms of Bitcoin. And the price of Bitcoins, I remember the first time I looked at it, it was like 35 cents. And now, last time I checked, it was over $100. So there's a huge bubble in the Bitcoin market, and it's a bubble of interest, and it's a bubble of price. I'm not comparing it to a market bubble or a, you know, an economic economy-wide bubble, but it certainly is all the rage. And it all got kicked off, of course, with events in Cyprus when they admitted that the banking system in Cyprus was bankrupt and that the Europeans would have to come in and rescue the country, and that that all depositors were going to be taxed in order to make a contribution from Cyprus to this bailout fund. And, you know, the consequence of shutting down the banks in Cyprus and the branch banks of Cyprus and other countries, you know, that makes major headlines. Not maybe with everybody, but with people with money, that really does matter. And, of course, the news spread to Greece, to Italy, to Spain, to Portugal, and other places. And so people are trying to get some diversification of their monetary holdings, and Bitcoin seemed to really just answer all the problems. And so, you know, it's really taken off. They're now starting to install ATMs where if you don't want to produce Bitcoins yourself, you can just go to an ATM that's coming real soon and put in your cash, and you use your electronic wallet, smartphone or whatever, and you're given the Bitcoins electronically as a result. And then you can turn around and electronically use those Bitcoins to give them to other people or to make purchases, things of that nature. So it's really taken off, and it's, you know, it's in 2013, it's made a huge splash because not necessarily because of what it is. I don't think it would have been taking off quite as much and getting all this attention had it not been for the reality, the real physical world out there, which is in a slow motion crumbling collapse, basically. And we don't know how far that's going to go, but we know it has longer to run, and that the consequences of banking systems melting down across Europe, you know, makes people want to have an alternative way to feed themselves and to put gasoline in the car and things of that nature. So what we expect is that governments are going to try to suppress this in some form or fashion, and that more and more people are going to start offering their goods for sale using Bitcoins.
I would also think that, to, you know, there's a lot of critics of Bitcoins because it didn't have the proper doesn't have the proper backing that we'd like to see with, you know, with a hard currency and that kind of thing. But I kind of look at it as, you know, maybe it's not perfect. Maybe it's not even, maybe in a totally free market where there was no government influence at all on the money system, maybe Bitcoins wouldn't work at all. But for now, since its competition is things like the euro and the dollar, I hate to use this phrase because it disgusts me so bad, but could Bitcoins just simply be the lesser of evils in choices right now?
Well, you know, I wouldn't call it evil. I think it's very well intentioned, and I think it's very well designed. You can't eliminate the possibility that this thing could crash and crumble, that governments could suppress it, and everybody could lose their money that way. But, you know, it's a sign of our times, and so in that sense, it's the lesser of two evils. But, you know, these coins, so-called coins, are based on real resources being used up. They're based on computing power and electricity. So there's a proof of resources and work that are going in to these coins, basically in solving complex calculation problems, so that real resources are involved here with Bitcoins, just like with gold. The first people to go after gold found gold on the surface and in little streams, and it was easy to pan out. Nowadays, we have to dig out, you know, entire mountains and refine tons and tons of raw materials before we get just 1 ounce of gold. So likewise with Bitcoin, The early users found the computations that they had to solve were fairly easy and they were fairly quick, and they resulted in coins that weren't really worth that much. Now it's getting harder and harder to solve those computations, and basically the system itself, through a random adjustment process, makes the computations more and more difficult to solve so that more resources have to go into it. It also accounts for the fact that computational power becomes easier over time, so those algorithms get more difficult to solve over time, and so the supply of bitcoins is going to slow down over time, and it will eventually max out at 21 million bitcoins. So these are real resources, unlike fiat money. These are scarce coins or money, unlike fiat money, which can be reproduced virtually, you know,
at will.
Yeah, in an unlimited way. And there's also, now there was an inventor of this system, but there's no central player in Bitcoin. It's all open source software, and everybody theoretically could be involved in this. But there's no central player, like with a central bank, that can rig the system and make it go in a certain direction to the negative impact of certain people and the positive impact of other people. And all coins have specific owners, property owners, which is a nice aspect of it, because we think in the Austrian school that money should be property that has what some people refer to as intrinsic value, but it just means real tangible value out there. I read that the system doesn't really allow for counterfeiting, or if it does, if the system is subject to counterfeiting, that there's ways of tracking down the counterfeiters. I don't know if that's, you know, that's not my specialization, knowing whether or not computer systems can be counterfeited, but that's the claim. I would even note that, of course, it's not that difficult to counterfeit gold itself. I mean, we've heard stories in history where people have made counterfeit silver bars and gold bars by taking base metals and covering them with silver or gold coating. So that all seems to line up much better with the gold standard relative to fiat money. So by and large, I think that Bitcoin has better properties than fiat money. And, you know, when you look at the actual physical production of bitcoins, it's competitive because anybody can get into it. And indeed, there are people all over the globe who are producing bitcoins or trying to produce bitcoins. As I mentioned earlier, it takes up capital, computers, and it takes up labor to do that. It takes time, which production processes typically involve. There's uncertainty of whether or not you're going to be able to produce bitcoins. And as I mentioned earlier, at least in a historical sense, there's decreasing returns from resources. So it has a lot of things in common with the real physical world out there.
Is it possible, and this is not my realm of expertise, so that's why I'm throwing it at you, is it possible that a better definition of what's happening with Bitcoin now, or rather than calling it a bubble, could it be considered a sort of a deflation as the value of the money, so to speak, increases in proportion to the value of goods and services?
Well, I don't want to call Bitcoin a bubble because it's really unlike what we typically refer to as bubbles. And it's one money set in terms of another. But you're right. A lot of the demand for bitcoins is the result of a decrease in the demand for paper fiat currencies. And so the value of bitcoins is going up, which means in relationship to goods and services, there is a dramatic deflation. Now, if you were one of the persons who were producing bitcoins in 2009 and 2010 in its early days, and you were producing bitcoins by the thousands and at a very low cost, you look at your CPI, and then all of a sudden you flash forward to today, and all those bitcoins are worth $100. Well, that means that that the prices of goods and services out in the economy, which are exchangeable in terms of bitcoins, have dramatically fallen in price. And so that, it's a price deflation effect for Bitcoin owners relative to the goods and services that are exchangeable in terms of bitcoins, which I understand, there's not a lot of vendors and retailers who are accepting bitcoins, but there's enough that you can basically buy many of the goods and that you would be interested in. And I think now the fact that bitcoins have gotten so much attention, and that the Cyprus situation and the fact that they've appreciated in value so much, I think we'll see an expansion of the ability to use bitcoins not as a store of value, but actually as a medium of exchange. It's a medium of exchange. That's its purpose. But I think, so far it's been a novelty item. It's been it starts out with its demanders who sort of oppose government money and oppose the banking system on ideological grounds, but it's continuing to the interest in it, it continues to expand outward, which is a necessary condition for it to have characteristics of money.
I think also something that may become a factor in it, a few years ago, the only thing PayPal was good for, and I realize it's apples to oranges here in comparison of the two. I'm only making the comparison because they're computer related. But a few years ago, the only thing PayPal was any good for was buying things from eBay. And now I have a PayPal card in my wallet, and I can actually go up to a gas station, swipe that PayPal card, fill up my gas tank, go to the hardware store, buy nails at the hardware store, swipe my PayPal card, and come back home and do my banking to clear out the accounts or whatever. And that didn't take a lot of time to leap from one spot to the other, to go from eBay only to being able to literally get a McDonald's hamburger with my PayPal. So I kind of tend to think that unless governments really bring the hammer down fast, I think bitcoins will probably make that leap as well.
Well, and that's how money originated too. I mean, money didn't, just immediately appear and everybody started using it. It was introduced by individuals who realized that particular goods were particularly useful to hold and then to resell. People would be, the expectations were that more and more people were going to be willing to accept this good in exchange for other goods. And so, that process took a very, very long time, in fact, thousands of years, and that silver coins and copper coins were only used in the most advanced places on the planet. And so real money took a very long time to become throughout the entire world economy. And these new financial innovations, the ones that succeed, are taking place at a faster and faster pace. And, Bitcoin is going to need the attention that it's grabbing right now to become a more widely used medium of exchange. And, we don't really have any way of scientifically making any sort of analysis of how that's going to play out with innovation such as Bitcoin. We just literally don't know. And even the people who, were in the initial stages of Bitcoin, there was a great deal of uncertainty, even amongst its proponents. They're looking pretty good right now.
Yeah, definitely. Just a note to my listeners, I had planned on having an interview with a person who actually works in a business that buys and sells bitcoins and gold and silver. And that person, I was going to use the interview today with Mark Thornton to sort of have, two different sides of the coin, but having one guy who is explaining the Bitcoin whole process from a salesman's point of view, and then have Mark Thornton on as the calm economist to keep us from going head over heels over this. Unfortunately, I haven't had the other guy's been busy, and I haven't got his interview yet. So, any of you listeners who had a whole list of questions for that guy, if you're listening today and you're saying, "Hey, Ben's not asking my question," hang in there. We'll get the Bitcoin guy on. But while I've got Mark Thornton on, I want to take advantage of his expertise in several different fields. Mark, we were just talking about goods and services. And prices. So as you mentioned to me during the break, there's still one thing left to happen with bitcoins that we're looking for, right?
Yes, that's correct. And you know, we think we're trading in bitcoins, but it's a little different than that. It's a very ultra low transaction cost mechanism in this system, and there are dealers for both the bitcoins and goods that are sold for bitcoins. And we even have ATMs being set up in places like Cyprus. But these coins are still, you know, they're still priced in dollars and euros. And bitcoins really are, at this point, would be considered a means of payment or a form of money. But it's not money in the sense that they're generally accepted means of transactions. And so it's more of a store of value and a means of payment, but it's not a full-blown money because we don't go to stores, either hard stores or internet stores, and find goods priced in money. That's something that's just trickling in at this point in time. So it's not a full-blown money, but the most important takeaway is that it's certainly not as dangerous as fiat money with central banking.
It's something that, in comparing bitcoins to fiat, there's a sort of a buzzword that's being rebirthed again on the internet, and that's the greenbackers. A lot of people are wanting to get rid of the Federal Reserve, which that's a good idea. But there are other people that are taking advantage of the frenzy to get rid of the Federal Reserve, and they're calling on Congress to begin issuing money directly from the Treasury as like those of us who know about this process derogatorily call it a greenbacker dollar in reference to Lincoln's use of it. And you're kind of an expert on the Civil War era, or I hate to use that word even, Lincoln's War of Aggression. You're kind of an expert on how the economy worked during that time. I want to throw a couple facts out for my audience and then just let you talk about what greenbacker dollars did during the Civil War, or so-called Civil War. We're going in the time frame from 1861 to 1865. The war started in April 1861. By July, essentially, the government was broke. And Mark, at any point in here where I say something wrong, be sure and correct me on this, because this is not my area of expertise. So in July, just a couple months after the war starts, the government issued $50 million. That's the my rough guesstimate is about $4 billion in today's money, going by the value of gold. By December the same year, the Lincoln's government was essentially they basically defaulted on their promise to pay that $50,000 in notes that they had issued. And then the following February, they issued another $150 million, and they started for the first time issuing $500 and $1,000 bills because of the inflation problem that they had created. By March of 1863, they had to issue another 450 million greenback dollars, And for the first time, they had to start issuing ones and $2 bills because gold and silver was being driven out of the market. Nobody wanted to let go of their gold and silver because of the inflation that was taking place with the greenback dollars. So now, Mark, correct me on any of that information that I said was wrong, and explain to the listeners why this folly did what it did and what it actually did to the economy.
Well, you know, simply put, the Union government's war effort to invade and to, you know, reduce the Confederacy in the South was a very expensive process. I mean, the Union Army at any particular time averaged, hundreds of thousands of soldiers. They had a very large Navy, and it was a very expensive process. And the president and the secretary of the treasurer promised that as they entered this war, that they would not give up the gold standard and that they would not inflate in order to pay for it. And of course, they lied about that. I mean, and within a very short period of time, they were issuing the fiat money by law, which were green banknotes issued by the government itself. And that's why they were called greenbackers for the green backing. And, and they ended up issuing more and more of these banknotes to pay for the war effort throughout the period 1861 to 1865. And actually the amount that they issued or spent into the economy grew over time because, of course, in response to this much larger sum of money in the economy, prices for goods and services increased. And of course, the South did the same thing to a much greater extent. And so the value of the Confederate paper money fell much more dramatically. And actually, in the final months of the Civil War, the South is faced with the prospects of hyperinflation and ultimately the money losing all of its value. There's a commonality between fiat money and war. Our monetary systems throughout history have broken down because of countries that have gone to war and then sought to pay for those wars by issuing paper money. And so we nowadays, for the first time in human history, human beings have think of unbacked paper government issued notes as being money, and we think of it as a normal sort of thing. We've all grown up with using paper money and token coins that have no underlying value. They're not backed up by anything. You can't trade them in for gold or silver. They're essentially have value, whatever value we place on those dollars, and however many are actually issued by the central bank. And the fact that we're forced to pay our taxes and our debts in terms of these government-issued banknote in the form of fiat money. So there was a big inflation in the Union. There was a big inflation in the Confederacy. The war comes to an end, and the Confederate currency is worthless. You can't use it to buy anything, essentially. Whereas the U.S. dollar still had remaining value, but the value wasn't the previous value in terms of gold. And so after the war, the Union government maintained that it would pay, would ultimately redeem all of these paper notes in terms of gold. And it took a long time for that to actually occur. I think it was over 10 years before they could actually seek to redeem all of these greenbacks in terms of gold. And so after the war, there was a persistent deflation as a result of the government's choice to go back to gold at the pre-war rate. And so the paper currency had to appreciate in a sort of a forced Fed way. And so the currency after the war, both silver coinage and the paper dollars, there was sort of a persistent shortage of it because of this policy. And there was a sort of a heavier than normal deflationary pressure. There were a few bank panics in that period of time. And people, you know, looking at the situation, basically said, you know, there's just not enough money. You know, the use of money had sprung out of the cities into the countryside in the United States. And now, under the National Banking Act and this redemption process, the amount of money available, physically available, just didn't seem like it was enough. And as a consequence, people thought the remedy for their economic woes was to increase the supply of money, to both issue more greenbacks and to have a free coinage of silver, so that there would be, instead of money being sort of restricted through this deflationary process, that we would have free coinage of silver, we'd have more of these greenbacks, and that would solve everybody's problem. The real problem was we had a faulty monetary policy and we had a war. I mean, if you don't have wars, you don't have the government running monetary policy, then you don't have those kind of problems.
That's kind of it. I kind of have a theory on this, and I haven't talked to an actual economist about this particular theory. So, you might have the opportunity to shoot it down, but it seems to me that governments love fiat money because they can engage in war, even unlimited amounts of war if they have unlimited amounts of fiat money. And so coming into the early 1900s, the tension specifically between Great Britain and Germany was at a real high level due to a lot of the problems they'd had with the Boer Wars and so forth. And the growing problem that had existed between France and Germany for some 70 years or so was kind of coming to a head. And so you didn't have to be a genius by about 1910 or 1912 to realize that there was going to be a problem. And you know, I believe that there were people in the United States who were just chomping at the bit for that to happen and for the U.S. to be involved in it. And so I kind of speculate that around the early 1900 that the movers and the shakers in the economy knew that the people still had the taste in their mouth from the greenbacker debacle that had happened 40 years earlier, and they probably weren't going to go for a true fiat money, and thus we had the Federal Reserve brought on in the way that it was. Now, do you think does that make any sense at all to you?
Oh, I think that's definitely in play. There's no doubt about that. And of course, these elites, these movers and shakers, we could call them, they're very attuned to these things that are happening overseas and in world markets and things of that nature. But your average American is working for a living and doesn't have the time and leisure to spend being informed on all this stuff. And, you know, they've got their job, they've got their family, they've got their business, and their attention is drawn elsewhere. So it's been relatively easy to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public time after time after time. You know, start rattling sabers over in North Korea, and pretty soon we'll have another big military dispute over there. And, you know, they're really playing, you know, like they did with Iran. They're still doing it with Iran. So, you know, this power of fiat money is something that, you know, it would be, you know, appealing to everybody. You know, the ability to increase your supply of money to an infinite level, practically speaking, while the cost of it, the price inflation being borne by everybody, that's so appealing. And I've even had people call me here at the Mises Institute, and they want to know how to set up their own fractional reserve bank, and they want to be able to create money. And, you know, I just got to tell them that that's a very exclusive right that's guarded very jealously by the U.S. government. And they're not going to give that up, and they're not going to, you know, they're not going to let that go unless there's a ideological uprising in this country, which I think is coming. And it's just it's the key to their power. It's, it gives them the ability to write blank checks to obtain resources and to, you know, move elections one way or the other. And so this is, we're going at the heart of the matter. Central banking and fiat money are at the heart of the power of the big brother state. And so, you know, the ability of the government to wean us off of gold coin money took, you know, a very long time. They had to prepare for several years before they could get the Federal Reserve Act passed in 1913. They actually had to draw up the legislation in secret with the big bankers and the powerful senators. And then, you know, they had the Federal Reserve in 1913, but it was a gold-backed Federal Reserve. You know, and then the Fed ended up causing the boom of the 20s and the Great Depression of 1929 and the early 1930s, which gave a leading cause for the government's ability to take away the gold. And so after 1935, we didn't have gold. That was all confiscated at a reduced rate, and we were left with a basically a paper money with silver backing, and it stayed that way until we became the world reserve currency for the entire globe after World War II, and we started abusing that position by spending too much money and buying too many things in foreign markets until 1971, when Nixon took us off, closed the gold window, and would not exchange the government's gold for the Federal Reserve notes, the dollar. And so that process took a very long time, and it continued on past that. I mean, the Monetary Decontrol Acts of 1980 and 1982 also moved us further away from traditional banking, things of that nature. It was supposedly a free market move, but what it resulted in is one of the largest increases in the supply of money in our history, basically. So it took a long time, even though Americans, you know, have a hard time with economics and keeping up with all this stuff. They knew that they were going to have a fight on their hands with the American people and interest groups that were not centered in New York City or in Washington, D.C. You know, your farmers and your ranchers and your manufacturers and your miners and your people like that, they know that paper money works against the interests of people who produce goods and services. And so it took them a long time, and it's taken us a long time to turn that fight around on them.
Now, I'd be doing my listeners a disservice if I had Mark Thornton on the phone talking to him and the opportunity to ask him about his first book, The Economics of Prohibition. I'd be doing a disservice to my listeners if I didn't bring that book up. Mark, it's a great book. It's spawned the phrase Iron Law of Prohibition. And I had this in my mind long before I ever heard the phrase or before I heard of you or your book or anything else. I observed firsthand that when something is prohibited and it's prosecuted the way that we see there, that it becomes more economical to transport and smuggle smaller, more concentrated parts of it, whether we're talking about brandy in the 13th century or, you know, opiates in the 1800s or cocaine in the 1980s. And that's basically you know, that's kind of the law of prohibition, the iron law of prohibition wrapped up in one phrase. But and I should have actually let you say all those things. But your book was one of the best things I've ever read on that topic.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. This whole iron law of prohibition, you know, the finding that if you put more law enforcement against trying to stop something, you actually make it more potent and more dangerous for the consumers was something that I developed in graduate school when I was on fellowship with the Mises Institute for the very first time. And, you know, it's something that most people can get their hands around, even if they haven't seen evidence, you know, in their own personal life. As a matter of fact, when people ask me what I'm famous for, I'll mention, you know, the Iron Law of Prohibition, and then I'll explain it just as you explained it. And the most responses I get is, you mean nobody had come up with that before? And I have to admit, you know, that's basically it. It's a pretty simple concept in economics, and it's just something that we extended to, you know, the unusual markets for drugs and alcohol, and it applies to just about everything. But in the alcohol prohibition from 1920 to 1933, what we saw is that the enforcement efforts on the part of the government, and the fact that you could end up in jail or prison, and that your property could be taken, meant that it was a big risk for most people to be engaged in rum running or bootlegging or moonshining, you know, all those terms that were developed to apply to illegal activities associated with the production distribution of alcohol products. And that increased risk, which was tangible and substantial, made for some big changes in the alcohol market. And the alcohol market is basically divided into spirits or whiskey, rum, things of that nature, wine, and then beer. And prior to Prohibition, Americans were a beer-drinking society. The wine consumption was quite limited to pockets of Southern European immigrants, such as the Italians. There was a substantial market in spirits or whiskey, but it wasn't nearly as big as beer. And so that's the situation before Prohibition, when alcohol was legal. When they prohibited it and they started enforcing it with the Volstead Act in 1920, what we saw is the consumption pattern, and at least the production pattern initially, and then eventually the consumption pattern, is that beer production fell almost to zero. You could get beer without alcohol in it legally, but you couldn't get regular old-fashioned beer. That just wasn't being produced. It's too big and cumbersome. You need, you know, a lot of equipment, and the amount of alcohol that you end up producing is quite small. But with whiskey or spirits, once you produce that product, you can move a very large quantity of alcohol from the point of production to the point of consumption, and you can hide that alcohol fairly easily. So you could take a couple of cases of whiskey from the point of production to the point of consumption, and they could be very well hidden. Where if you had to take the same amount of physical alcohol through that same route, the amount of beer, you'd have an entire truck load of beer. So it was easier to detect beer production and transportation. So basically what happened is that alcohol production went all into spirits, and it was usually the high-potency spirits, you know, like what we consider today, like Myers 151 rum, you know, which is over 150 proof. And so that's the kind of thing that was being produced, and it wasn't really all that great to begin with. I mean, it was sometimes it had bad smells, sometimes it had impurities in it that would make you sick or hurt your liver. So it was both more potent, and it was also just kind of a nasty product, and that's why in these speakeasies or these illegal bars, they basically had to find ways to make it more tolerable so that at the point of consumption, they would take this very potent, nasty whiskey and they would pour it in a glass with something else, like sugar or juice or, you know, whatever. And so the age of the cocktail was born, and hundreds and thousands of new cocktails were drawn up and or invented during this time in order to counteract the nasty, harmful product that was available, basically. And so, you know, they put things like orange juice in it to sort of try to protect your body against this what otherwise was poisoned. And so that, and then right after Prohibition was repealed, we basically went back to being a beer drinking country. So it was pretty obvious there in this natural experiment of Prohibition and repeal that Americans' taste didn't change. It was government policy that drove them to the more potent, the more dangerous drugs, and or alcohol in this case. And then I also studied the economics of marijuana prohibition, applying the same tool of analysis. And what I found there is that the data that I had, I got it from a government agency that was responsible for growing and tracking the government's marijuana programs, both the stuff that they grew for research as well as the stuff that, that was brought into them from the police. They would test the potency of this marijuana, and I got a hold of that data somehow. And basically what I was able to show is that from the beginning of the war on drugs until about the time of my dissertation in the late 1980s, that the potency of marijuana had increased dramatically over that time as the war on drugs became more and more effective in arresting more and more people and giving them more and more prison sentences, coming up with new detection devices and so forth, that over about a 12-year period that the potency of marijuana from this government study increased about 500%. And I understand that it's increased even further in the meantime, as the sort of the prohibition tightening around the marijuana market continued. And one thing to note is that marijuana is, in a relative sense, is more like beer than it is like whiskey. And it's kind of bulky. It takes a lot of room to grow. If you're growing it, it's sort of sitting there in the open where the police can find it. And then it's kind of bulky to move around relative to other drugs. So that while marijuana is kind of like the beer to the alcohol market, other harder, stronger drugs like cocaine and heroin are more like the whiskey component that are, you know, much more potent and much more potentially dangerous. I mean, there's probably more health issues that marijuana helps than it hurts. But cocaine, heroin, and even prescription drugs like Oxycontin, those things are very dangerous and lead to a lot of overdose deaths and, you know, emergency room visits and things of that nature. So another thing that we saw as we look at the war on drugs over time is that marijuana has become a smaller component of the marketplace, and that the more dangerous drugs take on a bigger and bigger play as a result. So we've seen more heroin and cocaine. We've seen methamphetamines, which is the poor man's drug. And then as those drugs were getting squeezed, what we saw is that a lot of people basically said, well, you know, these things are dangerous. They're made in the black market. If I can just get my doctor to think that I've got a bad back, I can get a prescription for Oxycontin or the Vicodin and things of that nature. But those things are very poor substitutes. They're very, actually very deadly, and that we see more overdose deaths with those prescription drugs as a result, more than even the illegal drugs. And so the government just seems to be pushing this prohibition agenda, but it's really resulting in worse and worse results. We have all these new, highly potent, highly dangerous drugs on the marketplace, and we have people, you know, doing crazy things like taking Oxycontin for their nerves, and, you know, making methamphetamines in their backyard. And it's really the chaos that prohibition has caused in humanity just really makes me want to weep.
Yeah, it's you know, Bastiat warns on taking actions. He didn't specifically say drugs, but he warns on the government actions like that that have repercussions that most people don't take the time to look at. On a business end, if you think of meth production in the, you know, it existed. Meth existed in the 70s and in the 80s in very small amounts. It was not a very popular drug at all. But as the drug war was prosecuted more and more heavy in the 80s, more people figured out they could that meth is not hard to make in your basement or in your backyard or whatever. And so there was a lot of mom and pop meth cookers that popped up out of nowhere and started supplying the demand. But then in the 90s, as the government started cracking down on the meth labs, and up into 2000, when there was a lot of hype about cracking down on these mobile meth labs and so forth, about 2000. And so now most of the meth is in the hands of these powerful cartels. Most of the meth production is done offshore in the hands of powerful cartels. So oddly enough, production, because of government action, the production is taken out of the private mom and pop market and pushed into pushed overseas. That we've lost the jobs to overseas, so to speak.
Not only have we lost the jobs to overseas, but we're destroying these countries. I mean, Colombia, there's been some improvement, I think, lately, but with our efforts, the U.S. involvement in Colombia in our prohibition of the cocaine trade nearly brought that entire country and its government to its knees. Bolivia, the same way, all the northern South American countries have high levels of corruption, have high levels of murder because of our policy of enforcing a worldwide drug prohibition. Now the Central American countries have been infiltrated, and these are countries that really don't have the ability to buy the types of things like helicopters and high-speed boats and things to even try to track down these drug dealers, these drug manufacturing operations, and the transportation routes which they take through their countries. And so you have entire areas of Central American countries that are completely lawless, which is saying something. And of course, Mexico. And, you know, so you see this rot because of U.S. policy. Mexico, there's a lot of corruption. All of the northern states of Mexico are in trouble with high murder rates, high corruption rates, with where police officers and military officers who try to enforce the laws are being killed. And there's a lot of other innocent people being killed in the northern states of Mexico. And, of course, that's bled over into the United States. And so we're seeing this South American crime that's ultimately based on U.S. drug policy, that's starting to rot into Southern California and into Houston, places like that, where these South American drug cartel companies are extending their reach into the United States and killing people, and, you know, in the process of getting their drugs across the border and to their markets and to their to the retailers that they serve. And then, of course, some of those retailers are drug street gangs. And so it's not just a point of entry that they're corrupting, but then the drugs and the weapons go to these street gangs, which, you know, ends up causing a lot more violence and a lot of crime, leaving a lot of urban areas basically lawless, where even the cops are kind of afraid to go. So it's an amazing story that all this could happen as a result of U.S. policy. But, you know, there's a lot of money in it. As Hillary Clinton said when she was at the border of Mexico grappling with the international relations with Mexico on these issues, she was asked whether or not drugs could be legalized, and she said that she didn't think that would really happen because there was too much money in it. Well, that tells you a whole big story in one punchline.
Mark, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. Did you want to give any kind of shout out to anything? We've already talked about the Mises Institute, but definitely I'll put a link to the Mises Institute in today's show notes. Anything else you'd like to give a shout out to?
Well, we have our most important program coming up this summer, Mises University, and that's a program for basically undergraduate students. to come and to learn for a week with the best Austrian economists, philosophers, so forth, historians, and they get a complete introduction to the Austrian economic school. So if you're out there and you're interested in Austrian economics and you're a college student and you would like to talk to other college students who are interested in the same thing and to get access to some of the great professors of the Austrian school, then that's a program you want to apply for. And the deadline is coming up very quickly, so get in line.
And they can do that also at Mises.org.
Yes. When you get a chance, maybe this weekend or so, just Mises.org and go and explore. Sign up for the daily articles. Look for the senior scholars of the Institute and our programs for students and adults. We have Mises circles around the country and Supporter Summit. We just had our 30th anniversary conference, and there's a lot of audio and video on there. You probably got about 2 or 3 years worth of audio and 2 or 3 years of video that you can get a great education in Austrian economics and learn how the world really works and why sometimes it doesn't.
Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. Mark, thanks a ton for coming on with me today.
I appreciate being on. I'd love to do it again.